Richard Kimball. The destination, Death Row State Prison. The irony, Richard Kimball is innocent. Proved guilty, what Richard Kimball could not prove was that moments before discovering his murdered wife's body, he saw a one-armed man running from the vicinity of his home. Richard Kimball ponders his fate as he looks at the world for the last time and sees only darkness. But in that darkness, fate moves its huge hand.
The Fugitive. A QM production, starring David Jansen as The Fugitive. Also starring Barry Morse as Lieutenant Gerard.
All right, and it's Talking Fugitive with Kitty and Bobby and Ken. That means it's starring Kitty and Bobby and Ken. Hi, everybody, and welcome back. I'm Dave White, live and in person. I know everybody was worried about me, but I am with you tonight. As once again, I guess you could say we've reached the end of the line, sort of. We'll be discussing the first of two final editions of The Fugitive. This would be called The Judgment. All right, picking up where we left off, and I should tell people, if they want to join in on the discussion, you can do so at 800-407-KSAV. And picking up where we left off 2 weeks ago, let's go back to the lead host, if you will, Bobby Neer.
Thanks, Dave. On our last program, we began our lengthy discussion of The Judgment Part 1, the series finale, where we were introduced to a new character named Gene Carlisle, who was an old Kimball family friend and just happened to suspect and then overhear a plot between Gerard and the L.A. police to lure Kimball into a trap, since they had the one-armed man temporarily in their custody after he assaulted two people during a barroom brawl. Kimball, who had been working as a truck mechanic in Phoenix, Arizona, went to L.A. after seeing in a paper that the one-armed man had been arrested. He was let off by a trucker who gave him a ride at the L.A. produce market. While there, Kimball makes a phone call to the cops and then finds himself trapped when the police show up with his wanted poster in hand. Just like that, Gene shows up in the nick of time, and although neither of the cops sees Kimball standing right out in the open, she finds him right away, even though she hasn't seen him in years and he has his hair changed to a different color. And she alerts him that he's walking into a trap. And the two make a nifty escape by purchasing a box of fruit and having Kimball perch it on his shoulder to hide his face. Well, it's almost a nifty escape until the two reach Gene's car. Kimball does something totally inexplicable that he has never done before and makes no sense given his extensive experience as a man on the run. Kimball goes to get in Gene's car and stops when he sees a cop directly in front of him. The cop, who also missed him when he was standing right behind him in a phone booth, is standing there. Instead of jumping into the car, Kimball stands transfixed, staring directly into the cop's face. I timed it, and incredibly, it takes 5 seconds. Now, Kimball has never done this, even in landscape, where he was totally out of his head and finding it work using his real name. Not even in Escape in the Black, when he had amnesia and didn't even know who he was or that he was on the run, did he do anything stupid like this. Ken, help me out here. What in the hell is Kimball doing?
It was one of the most dumbest scenes I've ever seen. Gene finds him. He's got the box of apples. He puts it up on his shoulders. It is so dull. The cops are so loony. I don't know if they had police cars or whatever, and I don't know how they escaped. Maybe the policemen didn't have cars. Maybe they were just patrolling the area. But he gets into the car, but he puts the box of apples down, I guess.
She puts it in the car, yeah.
The camera zooms in on Kimball.
Uh-huh.
He looks directly straight at the cop.
Right.
And you said 5 seconds?
That's right.
I mean, what about... You know, he's been a fugitive for 4 years on the run. He must know some basic survival skills. What in the world is he looking right straight into a cop's face?
Did this scene take place, or this take place in Mayberry, North Carolina, by any chance?
No, they weren't that stupid there, no.
Okay.
Not even Barney would have done that, no.
Wouldn't you know it, Bob, after 119 episodes, we get one of the most bizarre scenes all of us have ever seen?
Well, it makes absolutely no sense. I could almost understand it. if the cop had called out his name all of a sudden or startled him in some way, you might, if you're not thinking, look up, not realizing how much trouble you're in. But the cop had done nothing. He had not seen him. Neither one of, there were two cops in the produce market. Neither one had seen him at all. And so I don't have any idea why the writers wrote this. It looks, when you watch it, it almost looks like they were going to take it somewhere, but they didn't. I mean, I don't know what the purpose is of putting it in there, if it isn't followed by some sort of chase or something like that. But Kimball hops in the car, and they roar off, and the two cops are standing there in the middle of the street. And you're right, they apparently don't have a police car, because they don't even take it off after them.
Yeah.
So it's one of many things that happens. We're going to get to everything, but it's one of those ridiculous things. Kitty, what do you think about this insanity?
Well, I thought it was ridiculous, too, that Kimball would just look up and make eye contact with a cop. I mean, you would think that since he knows the police, I mean, he already knows the police are in the area because he was trying to make himself inconspicuous in the fruit market, and he went to the trouble of buying a box of fruit, and you would to use it as a shield, and so you would think that once he put the fruit in the car that he would bring his hand up to his face to kind of, you know, hide his face a little bit. You know, that's what a normal person would do, because we've certainly, I mean, I can remember seeing an episode where Kimball, at the very end of the episode, you know, saw a policeman walking by, and he immediately turned his back and took out a cigarette to light it. So it's not like he's a stranger to this type of scenario. It is weird.
Well, why go through the
sad part is that this is not the only time Kimball does it in the judgment, but we'll get to
why go through the trouble of picking up this box of fruit which they bought and putting it on your shoulder and hiding behind it and then getting to the car and giving it all away? I mean, it's just, I've watched it countless times, and I just don't get it. There had to be something. Somebody calls out his name, or there's something that startles him that would cause him to look up. But he simply stands there. And it's the kind of thing that fans of the series always put up with, and they always give them the pass. Oh, well, it's no big deal. But it is a big deal, because this goes on and on and on, over and over and over again in these two episodes. And it shows, I don't know what it shows, because I wasn't there when they wrote this nightmare. But somebody's not watching. Somebody's not thinking. I have no idea. It's one of the great mysteries of all time. So they do get away, which we knew they were going to do. It would have been made a lot more sense if they'd simply gotten in the car and driven away. And I believe there's a few minutes of a scene back in police headquarters where Gerard and the police chief, the L.A. police chief, were discussing this, because Kimball also had called up looking for the one. I mean, what about that, Kitty? Do you think that was smart of Kimball to call the police station and inquire about the one-armed man? Doesn't that kind of give himself away?
Well, yeah, it does. And in fact, weren't they tracing the call as he called it? Because they were kind of trying to keep him on the line, you know, they were pretending to see if they could find some information.
Well, the whole purpose was to set a trap so he'd come to L.A. and he goes in and gives it away. Oh, yeah, it worked. I'm here. I mean, I don't understand any of that. So after the produce market, the infamous scene in the produce market, finally, we have one of the few really good scenes in part one, and that is the confrontation between Gerard and the one-armed man, because they've got him in their custody, but it probably isn't going to last very long, quite frankly. This, as I said, is without a doubt the very best part. One of the best things about the episodes, it comes to the beginning of Act Two. And it's very well done, with some very interesting claustrophobic camera angles indicating that the one-armed man is finally trapped and can't get out. And Gerard finally loses his temper and practically assaults Johnson when he refuses to admit that he was in Stafford the night of the murder. Well, it's a good scene, but I still have complaints, of course. I think it's too early in this episode for this to happen. The writers treat this scene as though it's just another scene, when in fact we've been waiting, indeed begging for it, for 4 years. Plus, it is much too short, cut off in favor of going back to Gene's apartment, which Ken will get to discuss in a little while, because I know that he had that in his review. But first, I want to say that I think they missed a golden opportunity here. The one-armed man simply tells Gerard that he never killed anyone, end of story. But what if he had blurted out just one little thing about the crime scene that only a man who was there that night would know? Gerard would have noticed, swallowed hard at hearing this, and said nothing in return, but he surely would have remembered it. Now, I say this because in part two, which we will get to later, Gerard suddenly and inexplicably gets on Kimball's side and helps him prove he was innocent. It makes no sense at all, since there's still no proof of anything. And I said that in my review. It looks ridiculous for Gerard to change that way. Had they started it here and planted a sliver of doubt in his mind after he talks to the one-armed man, I think it would have made more sense for Gerard to do a slow change of mind over time in part two. Kitty, what do you think about this?
Well, from my perspective on this, as I put in my review, I was actually glad to see that Gerard was finally taking a proactive viewpoint in wanting to address or question the one-armed man. As I put in my review, that he's a little late to the party, but better late than never, because as we all know, the one-armed man was in custody back in season three. And Gerard really was not the least bit interested in talking to him, even though he's been interested in talking to everybody else who's admitted to killing Helen Kimball. And now you had a one-armed man who actually did admit to it, and he wasn't even the least bit interested in discrediting his story like he's done with the others. So I was actually kind of glad to see that occur. I'm kind of, you know, it probably came a little too early in the episode. It might have been a little more interesting if it had come maybe in the last act, you know.
Well, they almost throw it away as if it's not important.
Yeah.
But you don't like the idea of something being blurted out all of a sudden?
I think it would have been good, although it sounds like Gerard has figured it out that he's definitely a strong suspect. He, after all, he was working at a place that was not that far from Stafford, Indiana.
Yeah, but that's a far cry from placing him at the scene of the crime.
Yeah, you know, and this is where it's a shame that they didn't think to bring back Captain Eckhart and put Fred Johnson in a lineup and say, you know, can you tell me, is this the guy you saw running out of Kimball's house on that night?
Ken, what do you think about this?
It was an excellent scene. The first time I saw the episode, you know, I was 12 years old, so it didn't mean much to me back then. But obviously, in 1993, I saw it again, and then, you know, I've seen it again recently. I'm kind of upset at the section of the cross-examining between Gerard and Johnson, because it was way, way too short. You remember an episode, May God Have Mercy,
yeah,
Gerard and Leonetti.
Yep.
And remember that cross-examining?
Sure, yeah.
And that just went on and on.
That's
and
right.
on.
Yeah, but keep in mind, Victor Leonetti had actually admitted to killing Helen Kimball, so he was trying to discredit him.
But
whereas in this case, he was trying to get Johnson to admit. I mean,
but what I wanted
do when
was,
the guy keeps saying, no, I didn't do it?
Well, what I wanted was a lengthy cross-examination. I mean, why not make it maybe 5, 6, 7 minutes, you know, and just really have Gerard probe at him, you know.
How about doing it more than once?
I mean, how many questions did he ask him? Maybe 5 or 6?
Oh, it wasn't many.
Yeah, and then you know what I would have liked also, Bob?
What?
Is I think they should have done it where Johnson, you know, at the beginning of the scene, have Johnson sitting there by himself. And
right.
then Gerard walks in slowly,
right.
and then they have eye-to-eye contact.
Right.
Wouldn't that, would have that been good?
Well, you know, I mean, we've been waiting for this for 4 years. Remember in Wife Killer, where the one-armed man gets injured, and Gerard shows up, Kimball has already run away, and the woman reporter is telling him, there's the one-armed man, he admitted that he killed her, you got to talk to him, and Gerard says, we'll do it later. The trouble is, when he does it later, he's already escaped.
All right, we're going to have to, we don't go for that later stuff, but, you know, I have a question for you guys to ponder. If you know, Kimball is on the phone, and he knows that the police are tracing the call. That means he's talking on a wiretap, and it could be that he was trying to run for governor of Illinois. All right, we're going to take a quick time out.
Not corrupt enough for that.
Stick around. We'll be right back. Talking Fugitive here on Sure Vision Radio.
Friends, Here's a wonderful Christmas gift for anyone who smokes, because it says, Merry Christmas and Happy Smoking 200 times. Yes, 10 packs of those better-tasting Luckies, all done up for Christmas in a beautiful carton created just for Lucky Strike by the famous designer, Mr. Raymond Loy. It'll look so bright and colorful under your Christmas tree, and it's such a welcome gift to anyone who enjoys a good smoke. Because, you know, smoking enjoyment is all a matter of taste. And the fact of the matter is, Luckies taste better. Cleaner, fresher, smoother. That's why you can't go wrong if you remember your friends with these colorful Christmas cartons of Lucky Strike.
Be happy, go lucky for Christmas gifts this year.
All right, we're back talking a little more Fugitive with the Big Three, Kitty and Bobby and Ken. All right, pick up where we left off, further discussion of the Fugitive episode, The Judgment, and here's Bobby Neer.
Okay, Dave. After tonight's program, we're taking 4 weeks off for the holidays, and we certainly wish everybody a happy holiday. But we plan to return on January 13th, 2009, to continue our discussion of Part 1 of The Judgment, picking up from wherever we leave off at the end of today's show, probably while Ken's in the middle of the sentence again. In the meantime, you're invited to visit the Fugitive Views and Reviews group, where Kitty's story, entitled From Here on Out, which details what happened to the main characters after the judgment, has now been fully posted over a three-week period on our message board. By the end of the year, it will be archived permanently in our files section. An excellent story, well worth reading. Kitty actually had the colossal gall to do what the writers never did, which is to let us know what happened to certain very important people and bringing people back. What an incredible concept. If only somebody had thought about it while the show was on the air 40-some years ago. Anyway, Ken gave it a rating of an 8, and I would not disagree with that. It's an excellent story. And Ken is very hard to please on things like that, so that should tell you something. It's on our message board. It will be, as I said, in the file section. If you have not read it, I suggest it. Then beginning next week, because it is Christmas week, we will post Kitty's Christmas story, which was posted, I believe, about 2 years ago, which takes place in Las Vegas. We'll have that in three parts, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. It is more timely than ever and also well worth reading, especially if you have not read it before. Okay, back to the judgment. Before we leave this business about the this confrontation between Gerard and the one-armed man, I want to say that in Ed Robertson's book, The Fugitive Recaptured, George Eckstein, one of the writers of this incredible travesty, points out that in this confrontation, when Gerard demands of the one-armed man, did you kill Helen Kimball, and then actually grabs him and shakes him, that what he really wants to hear, supposedly, is the one-armed man say definitively that he did not do it, because Gerard is supposedly afraid of hearing the truth, which is that, you know, that he did it. He wants him to continue to say, I didn't do it. Eckstein says that's what they had in mind when they wrote that particular part of the episode. Ken, I'm not so sure about that. Did you take it that way?
Johnson doesn't answer the question. He kind of gets up, right?
Yeah.
And walks over near the window. And then Gerard has that mean look on his face. And then Gerard confronts him and grabs him. I didn't like that. Did you like that part where Gerard grabbed Johnson? And
well, it's out of character. I can't say that I had any problem with it. Why didn't you like it?
I thought it was just a little off. I would have liked Gerard being a little bit more smart versus being a little rash right
A little
there.
More subtle about it.
Huh?
A little more subtle about it.
Yeah, a little bit, you know, really trap him. I mean, really, get the right answer from Johnson.
So you don't think he could shake the truth out of him?
Huh?
You don't think he could shake the truth out of him?
He could have gotten Johnson in a trap. He really could have.
Yeah, well, that's what I was thinking. Kitty, did you have any problem with this? Was Gerard getting this angry all of a sudden?
Well, I didn't really have a problem with him getting angry, but obviously police procedures have changed over the years because the fact that he touched Johnson, in this day and age, he could have filed a complaint against him and maybe brought a lawsuit him for that. But, no, I didn't really mind him getting angry. It would have been nice, I agree with Ken, it would have been nice if he could have, and I agree with you, too, that it would have been nice if he could have gotten him to admit something without him realizing that he was admitting that he was there.
Do you agree with one of the writers of this episode that in this particular scene, Gerard really does not want to hear the truth from the one-armed man? Because
no.
It'll validate the fact that he's been chasing Kimball all this time?
No, I don't really think so, because I've always been of the opinion that Gerard is so arrogant that he doesn't need to hear the one-armed man say no. I think he, you know, I always took it to mean that especially since he found out that the one-armed man had actually been in Indiana and he was able to place him in Stafford, that was enough to cause him, you know, for the first time to really question, you know, maybe Kimball was telling the truth all along. And I think he did. I think he was just trying to get to the truth. I don't think he wanted to hear a lie. I think he really was trying to get to the truth.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. And the reason I agree with it is because I don't think that Gerard really cares. I'm talking about overall, and as we get to the end of the series, whether he's been right in chasing Kimball all this time or not, because he's always indicated that he's just, he's just following the law. You know, the old business about the law says he's guilty, and I enforce the law. So he can't be bothered by stuff like that. All he knows is that he was supposed to take him back to death row. He got away, and now it's his job to go and find him. If in the end he's really innocent, well, let somebody else worry about that. You know, don't tell it to me. Don't tell it to Gerard. Tell it to the jury who got it wrong, or tell it to the prosecutor who broke all the rules of the trial, or tell it to his defense attorney. So I don't think when he's talking to the one-armed man, he really cares one way or the other. I think he just wants to know the truth, but, you know, I don't think he's really thinking to himself. I mean, they wrote it that way, obviously. They wrote it. But when I was watching it, I really didn't think of it that way. At any rate, this scene, as Ken indicated, does not really go on long enough. I personally think that it should have been more than one scene. Should have talked to him, should have gone back later, and over a period of time, perhaps he would have, Gerard would slowly lose his temper. That way, when he finally grabs him like that and shakes him, you can see that he's had enough. He's not going to stay in here and have the one-armed man play hardball with him. He loses his temper. Ken may be right. I mean, it's out of character for Gerard to suddenly go crazy like that. But, why, and I know Ken's going to have something to say about this, why did they have to keep it short? Because we have to have a really intimate scene back in Jean Carlisle's apartment where we have to sit and listen to her life story. Right, Ken? How exciting was that?
Oh, my God. They spent way too long on Jean Carlisle. I mean, are you talking about the apartment?
Well, she goes back to her apartment. Remember, they're sitting there talking, and she's making a salad or something.
Is that the next
scene?
She talks
about her father, huh?
Is that the next scene right after this cross-examination?
Yes. I just looked at it a few hours ago.
She basically tells him all about her father and everything.
Her life story. Her father, wasn't he accused of embezzlement or something?
Yeah.
And she starts talking about Stafford and the lousy people in Stafford. I mean, who wants to hear this? We've got more important things to care about. I don't care about her life story.
Just imagine how much time they spent with Donna in the beginning on the phone call, and then compare the scene with the salad tossing and how do you like your steak, and Kimball kind of gushing a little bit, and Jean is just being a little sappy. Wasn't that the low point of this episode?
Oh, well, there are a lot of low points. I haven't gotten to them all yet. let me just say that this scene, the thing that really galls me about this scene is that it follows what essentially is, truly, one of the most important scenes in the entire series, and that's Gerard talking to the one-armed man. We've been sitting there for 4 years, and Kimball has asked him repeatedly, over and over and over again, talk to him, you've got to talk to that man. He really, really did it. So finally, you get to that scene, you go, oh my God, I waited all this time, and it wasn't for nothing. And they just kind of toss it out there, and they go, okay, well, Gerard talked to him. You happy now? And the water man said, no, I didn't kill anybody. And Gerard got angry, and then he left the room, and that was it. We can't dwell on this because we have to get to Jean's apartment to find out about her. Now, this is, you know, at the beginning of the story, as I mentioned on another show, she looks like she's just a family friend. She may be just there as a plot device. I don't really mind it so much. But it's in this scene in her apartment where this goes on that it really begins to come apart, and I really get angry. It goes on and on and on and on, and it is absolutely pointless. Then later on, Kimball stays there overnight, Ken, and do you remember when Jean Carlisle went to bed and got up in the middle of the night and looked out the door and saw him sitting up in the middle of the night in the living room? You remember that?
Yeah.
Yes, I remember that.
Yes, and it seemed to me that she was seriously considering giving him a little overnight comfort that would make him feel better. But it's, you know, it's 1967, not 2008, so they don't go anywhere with that. But it's at this point that it becomes apparent that Jean Carlisle's not just there as a plot device, she's there as a love interest. And this, for me, is the beginning of the end of this story. What do you think, Kitty?
I would agree. I think I would have preferred her to just be a family friend.
Oh, yeah.
My opinion on bringing in a new love interest to have him with him at the end of the series, this would have worked better if they had, like, introduced Jean Carlisle a couple episodes back. You know, that would have made it a little more believable.
Yes, I would have had even more time to hate her that way.
But, you know, when you consider all of the other ladies that he encountered along the way, and you're telling us that none of those ladies or the actresses who portrayed them were available, you know, to do the finale, that it just seems kind of silly.
She doesn't appear in this particular scene. This is the first extensive scene between the two of them, and it becomes obvious while you're watching it that the writers are up to no good, that they're going to take it further than this. And we don't know yet just how bad it's going to be. But this scene, Ken, you had to be furious because this took time away from exactly what you were waiting to see. It took valuable time away from that confrontation between the two of them.
Right. I've been complaining about the Kimball case because if you're following all the
episodes... One minute.
Okay. If you're following all the episodes through the years, we really do not know what in the world happened that night.
Absolutely.
We have no idea what happened. Kimball's convicted. He's on the run. He's chasing this guy. We don't know about him. Gerard has the obsession, and that's the main thrust of the series. So I'm looking for answers. And, I mean, I'm watching The Judgment. Where are the answers?
Well, and that's what makes you wonder, why are they wasting time? I'll tell you why they're wasting time, because they don't want to do that. They don't want to give answers. They don't want to do any of that. So they don't leave any time for it. That way, nobody can complain.
Do you think that they might not have come up with the answers, even at this late date?
Oh, I'm sure that Will Huggins, when he wrote the original treatment for the series, didn't write any answers himself. So, of course, they didn't know what actually happened.
All right, well, that answers it, but we're going to find out what happens, at least as far as this discussion goes, not in 2 weeks, but in 4 weeks. January the 13th, we will be back after what is hopefully for everybody a pleasant and happy and successful holiday season. So wrapping up another year of Talkin' Fugitive, and I will tell the three hosts here, happy holidays to all three of you, and I look forward to rejoining you and the audience 4 weeks from tonight, January the 13th. We'll pick up for more discussion of The Judgment when we start yet another new year here on KSAV Cherevision Radio. Got